Now entering Nerdist.com.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And sitting opposite us here at our table in the Palatial Studios in Los Angeles, where we record this, is a young woman who is equally known as Jenny Slate and as the voice of Marcel the Shell. I think they kind of compete with each other.
Do they?
In terms of recognition.
Sure, I think.
In terms of recognition, yes. Not in terms of talent or versatility.
Right.
Marcel perhaps is a little less versatile than you.
I think he probably is, although he has a great emotional expanse.
I disagree.
Yeah?
I think Marcel is everything. I think that Marcel is all emotions in one.
He has a different range. He has a different existence. But he's fully integrated into me because he comes from inside.
Well, of course. You just said that about something that comes from the inside. On the outside right now, I told you just before we started recording that I was a little bit intimidated by the fact that you showed up wearing a Jean-Luc Godard T-shirt, masculine, feminine. That's my bad high school French, junior high school French.
Well, it sounds great.
Not to French people. I've tried it, believe me.
He's a French film nut. He loves French film.
Oh, I'm a sucker for French
film. I think
film.
You love it more than you love anything else.
Do you like Jacques Tati?
Of course.
All of it.
Me too.
Of course. All of it.
Me too.
In fact, I don't want to get off on a tangent.
Seeing
the 70mm print of Playtime here in LA.
Whoa, come on.
Is just one of the greatest experiences.
And the Pierre Etex evening you got to do that
Pierre Etex, yes.
That was pretty cool. Have you seen him?
I haven't.
Okay.
He was kind of a collaborator and then protege, both, of Tati. Not as well known. He won an Academy Award, though, for a short he did in the 60s. And he's been somewhat rediscovered. He just passed away, but he was somewhat rediscovered late in life and also of great talent. Real original. Criterion did a whole box set.
Oh, really?
Of his stuff. So
I wonder if it's on Hulu. They have the whole Criterion thing, don't they?
I think they do.
Well, you're gonna find out.
Yeah, I will.
Oh, one of the things he's most famous for is motorizing beds, and the scenes are you must watch.
Cool.
You must watch because they're so cool and ridiculous.
I want to take it in.
I'll leave it there.
Much. Yeah.
That's a good idea. Yeah. Good idea. Anyway, hi.
Hi, guys. It's so nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you here. We're going to certainly do our due diligence in plugging your new movie, Landline.
Thank you.
He always looks directly at the publicist when he does that. He's like, don't worry. We're going to say the thing.
Well, you know why I do that? There's a reason I do that. Is for years and years and years, I went on book promotion tours.
Yeah.
This is now decades ago when my annual movie guide was coming out. And there were still a lot of bookstores. And most cities of any size had a morning TV show, local morning TV show.
Sure.
Sometimes a mid-morning or a noontime TV show. And then there were a lot of local radio. So it paid to go from city to city.
Yeah.
And there were some shows that refused to give you the plug.
Oh.
There's one in Detroit, I'm thinking, you know who you are if you're listening
right
now.
I've never seen him this angry.
Yeah. Oh, well, because I have an elephant's memory about this kind of thing, where twice, 2 years in a row, they wanted to act as if I just happened to be in the neighborhood and dropped in.
Right, that's just weird.
And talked about what they wanted to talk about.
Right.
Never mentioned the book, and they're going to, the stage manager's counting down toward off the air. And I have to say, and my new book's out.
It
doesn't feel good at all. So I like to play fair.
Yeah.
And even though we're going to talk about a lot of different things, want to make sure we mention the most prominent current item on your agenda, which is your new movie called Landline.
Yes, it's called Landline, and I love it very much. I'm glad you mentioned it.
And it's directed by Gillian Robespierre, who also directed your first starring movie.
Yeah.
Obvious Child. And it has a rather extraordinary co-starring cast.
It does.
I mean, really swell people.
Yes. We've got John Turturro, Edie Falco, Jay Duplass, Finn Wittrock, and Abby Quinn.
And who plays your sister.
She plays my sister. It is, I will say, I mean, it's hard to figure out how to talk about your work, but I just think all the performances are fabulous. I really think they're wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a very believable, they're a very believable couple.
Mm-hmm.
You're playing your parents.
Yes.
And I'm a big fan of John Turturro, always have been. Mm. I wish more people would give him comedy to do because he's good at
it. He's really
funny. He's awesome at it.
Really and funny. And he doesn't get any props for that. And
yeah.
He's really good.
Yeah.
He was wonderful. He was so loose and fun and mm-hmm. And he really has a streak to him that feels like he has the it's not adolescent, but it's like he has this thing in him that just feels fresh, yeah. Really fresh. Yeah. While he comes off as our father on screen, he's such a specific identity that he's really like John on set. I don't know if that describes it. But then also, like, you know, there was a night where it was really, really cold and he was just so concerned that Abby and I, you know, are like, get coats and that we're, you know, in the warming van. And I was like, oh, yeah, he is a dad.
Yeah, no, yeah, in real life, he's a parent.
And he's a real life
exactly,
dad. And
right.
I was like, oh, yes, of course, you know, he's a real life dad. Yes. And it came out.
Mm. Now, what I really want to ask you is how you hooked up with Gillian Robespierre, because you first worked on a short subject of Obvious Child, which then she expanded into a full-length script with her writing partners, and you got to play the leading role. And this is not a typical role for a stand-up comic to tackle.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not shoehorning or pigeonholing you in any way, but I mean that's a real performance.
Yeah,
with a lot of range and
well,
a lot of ambition.
It's the idea that some people want to be actors and some people want to be comedians and some people don't want to be both.
Right.
And if you do want to be both, that can be difficult at times because if people just think you're funny.
Yeah.
We got to bring Nick Kroll on the show.
Uh huh.
And we talked about him being in Loving.
Right.
And my dad, who hadn't seen him too much, told me that in the theater when they were watching the movie, the first time he came on screen, people were laughing and he and my mom didn't know why.
Yeah, yeah, totally. You know, luckily for me, I actually don't think that happens. And I think that, I'm not exactly sure, and I try not to think that hard about it, but I do know that I became a stand-up comedian because I was freaked out by the way that it seemed that women have to sort of, I don't know, quote unquote, enter the entertainment industry.
Mm-hmm.
And even though I actually knew nothing about it, the rumors of a community of people that sort of objectify women and kind of make them pay for it in a way, mm-hmm. you know, really put them through something was so terrifying and unattractive to me and really not tied to what I loved about seeing actresses on film. Like, I grew up being like, okay, I love Ruth Gordon. I love Madeline Kahn. I love Gilda Radner. I love Amy Irving. And, you know, and like, you know, and more like my teenagers, like, I love movie actresses like Michelle Pfeiffer. Mm-hmm. Love her. Mm. Love her. Like, her Catwoman. Just watching that performance, I was like, what the hell? This is, like, the best.
Yeah.
You know, way to be a live wire within a really traditional thing. And so I believed that you can be irreplaceable within a system. But I was, like, within a system that kind of is very in place, right? And I was like, I don't know. I went to Columbia. I was afraid of getting eaten alive. So my access point, my most honest, joyful thing where I feel strong is comedy. So I started to do stand-up, even though I really didn't know anything about it and didn't enjoy watching stand-up. I love talking, and I like myself, and I like my stories from my life, and I like people. So I was like, I don't know how these guys do it, but this is what I like, so I'm pretty sure they're going to laugh. Whatever. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know. So I went and I started to do this.
But it's very gutsy. Mm, You're saying it in a matter-of-fact way, but that's very gutsy.
I guess so, but it's so scary to be sad. Mm-hmm. It's so scary to see your dream, like, through a fog, mm-hmm. you know? And I was saying this yesterday, like, the way I feel about acting is the same way that I feel about falling in love. I feel incredibly, like, romantic and like, dreamy and really, really soulful about it. I've always felt that way. And being able to be an actress feels like meeting someone who's going to, like, love you and please you and give you treats in all the ways that are just for you. That's what it feels like to me. And it's all I want. And I mean, especially as like a divorced person, I'm like, and I'll lean more on acting now than I work out that. But I do think I've never thought of myself as a comedian. I have always thought of myself as a really flavorful person.
Mm-hmm.
And a nice person and a smart person. And I like those things about myself, and I guard them, and I don't think there's anything wrong with exploring that. But anyway, so when I met Gillian at a comedy show,
mm-hmm.
to answer your question, and she, and I didn't know her. She was a stranger. We had a mutual friend, and she was planning, she had written the script for the short of Obvious Child, but mm-hmm. Donna Stern at that point, the character that I play, was not a comedian. We made the short. Donna was just a freelancer, and it was really about sort of the central thing of is there a way that a woman can have an abortion and it's not like her destiny or the flag that she flies? Is there a way that a woman can just make a choice about her body and have it be integrated into a fuller experience? Mm-hmm. And so we made that, and then I just wanted to do it because she said that she saw me on stage and she identified me as a friend, even though we were strangers.
Hmm.
I felt that because she said that, that she understood why I was trying to be there. I really wanted to be an actress. I didn't want to be, like, on a sitcom, you know, even though I grew up enjoying The Golden Girls. I love The Golden Girls, mm-hmm. and I loved, like, Roseanne, and I loved Cheers, and I loved Friends so much, you know, and Seinfeld. I wanted to be, like, if I could be anyone, I was like, I want to be, like, I don't know, like, what, like Amy Irving. I was mm-hmm. obsessed with Amy Irving.
I mean, it's Amy Irving. A solid person to be obsessed with. Yeah. You gotta be
like,
obsessed.
Sissy Spacek. I wanted to be like that. And so I was just like, this woman who I don't know, who's written this story that is not like anything I've seen, that's, I want to go through the door that looks like a heart to me. That lady, that's the one. So I just started to hang out with her.
And what incredible connection. Yeah. What incredible way to make a connection, though.
Yeah. And also, you know what was really cool about her was that I had gone through this thing where I was sort of like, I'm not getting up on stage and wearing like a sweatshirt and acting like I'm a boy in that sort of gendered way, like
mm-hmm.
having to put on the mantle of the gender that's sort of in charge. I would always get on stage and dress like I was dressing for a date with like a nice man.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so not super bent towards the male gaze, but kind of being like, I have a figure and stuff like that, and I like it. And Gillian dressed me in a totally other way. She put me in like Crocs and huge sweaters. And I was like, oh no, like you're taking away. And she helped me find this middle zone of femininity that also, if you go back and you watch something like You've Got Mail, yeah. you look at like Meg Ryan's big sweaters.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, she's actually kind of calling back to that.
Mm-hmm.
This sort of like classy, comfortable thing. But anyway, so we made the short, and then I actually randomly did kind of start working. I got on, my first job was on Bored to Death, which is on HBO.
Mm-hmm.
I met Jason Schwartzman, and he and I enjoyed working together, and I didn't have an agent, and he sent his agent to come and see me. And so that's how I got an agent. And then I wound up on SNL, and after I got fired from SNL after 1 year, about a year after that, Gillian was ready to make the feature of Obvious Child, and we made it together.
Now, how much input did you have to the final screenplay of the feature?
I had a bit, but I really like people to kind of give me their thing.
Mm-hmm.
But what I did have specific notes about was the stand-up. Because I think it's really hard, if you're not a stand-up, to write that. You know, it's like, usually the rhythm is off, the culture is off. It's, you really got to be inside of it. It's very, very hard. And I just was kind of like, I don't want to be a stand-up comedian only. I want to be everything. But I've got to say, you have to honor this art, and that's not what it is. And you've written like a 45-minute set, you know, and like this is all too structured. And so on the day, so I was like, you just got to, let's leave this in for now, but I can't do this for you because
mm-hmm.
it's super, it's not the way that it is. And I just like, ugh, I'm cringing. And so not because it's not funny, it's just not honest. And so on the day, which was like 6 a.m, we bullet pointed what she wanted me to say, and I did an improvised stand-up set for the 7 extras who were there at 6 a.m., And, you know, and then she edited that down to whatever it is in the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is how we did all of them, including the last speech in that movie where Donna is sort of like, I'm getting an abortion. Because I also was like, do you know what it's like when people get on stage and have some sort of breakdown where they're just like, you know, like I was here during 9/11 or like I have an eating disorder or whatever it is. You're always like, ugh, this is really more for you.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's what the character was trying to do. And I was like, this really makes me cringe. I don't think we're going to be able to make it work. I've never seen it work. But then in the movie, it works. And I think it's because we improvised it, and they rewrote while we were improvising it, and we really just, like, worked it in. But it was hard. I was nervous.
Well, it turned out fine.
Yeah, it worked. It turned out fine.
So, did she come to you then with another finished script or an idea that became Landline?
Just actually a very vague idea.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. When Obvious Child came out and we had a lovely reception, there were people who were kind of like, what's your next thing?
Always.
Yeah.
That was really great. What else do you have?
Yeah, what's next?
Why can't we enjoy this thing? Because we're done with it now. What's next?
Yeah, totally. As if you're just like, you know, a Pez dispenser.
Right.
Which is not, you know, typically the way that my art happens. But
not that there's anything wrong with Pez dispensers.
No, I mean, Pez dispensers are cool, and so many wonderful characters have been immortalized in that type of candy dispenser. But I think Gillian and Liz... Elizabeth Holm, who is Gil's co-writer and our producer, they both shared an experience where their parents got divorced when they were both 16 years old in their native Manhattanites. And they were kind of like, well, okay, we might as well jump on this while people are asking. And sort of were just like, we want to make a comedy about divorce. Will you be in it? And I said yes, because I would rather work with them than not work with them. And I believe in them. And... that's belief, that's faith. So they sold an idea with my name attached, and then they wrote a script.
Wow.
Now, I have a theory. It's always dangerous to present theories to filmmakers or people involved with films, because they say, no, that wasn't the idea at all.
Sure.
But
now he's going to share
you're
it with
safe, you. You're safe, Leonard, you're safe.
Oh, okay. It's set in 1995.
Yeah.
Should I tell her my theory, or should I ask her why?
Tell us this theory.
That's all you.
Okay, well, my theory is that the reason it's set in 1995 is that by doing that, you don't have to deal with texting.
Yeah.
You don't have to deal with cell phones.
You avoid technology in a large way.
But you avoid the fact that if you set it today, everybody would be having their nose in an iPhone device or something like it.
An iPhone device?
Well, something I was trying to make a generic.
A smart
device.
Yes,
device.
A smartphone, exactly. An intelligent mobile device,
sure.
Yes. Or an iPhone.
Yeah.
And texting all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And by putting it 20 years ago, you take that out of the picture.
Yeah.
Other filmmakers have done this, too.
Yeah.
For just that reason.
Yeah.
They want to have, it's about human interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we we all felt that way. I think that's totally true.
Mm-hmm.
That is one of the reasons. And it goes further than that. It's first of all, I think the three of us are kind of like, phones are ugly. It's a really bummer way to figure out a point in a narrative to have some sort of insert shot on like a phone. It's gross. I don't like it. I don't like receiving information that way in film. And it's ugly.
Yeah.
It's just straight up ugly. But not human. I mean, categorically not human. But going more into that. We all, I mean, Liz is younger than me and Gil, but we all came of age during a time when you still had to talk to people.
Yeah.
You know, and if you were going to meet them and you didn't show up, they wouldn't know. You would have to, like, call a restaurant. You know, you would have to, we're really, the social responsibility is so much more there was just like so much more emotion in it.
You couldn't cancel 5 seconds ahead of time. You
yeah.
couldn't disappear because it would be.
There are a bunch of 80s movies that I, New York 80s movies in particular, that I now refer to as payphone movies.
Yes. Yeah.
Because so
all everyone
much time
is doing
is spent.
Walking in,
yeah.
putting the quarters. Hello.
Putting coins in the payphone.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, and I have a huge thing about phones anyway, and like this horrible feeling that's like, How could we possibly not have major emotional and cognitive dissonance about the fact that we are entitled to our privacy, like no one can know our passwords and like, you know, to our thing, and but also are expecting complete access to everyone at all times?
Yeah.
Well, I texted her 4 minutes ago. Why isn't she writing me back? Does she hate me?
Mm-hmm.
Is she denigrating my identity? You know, it's like, I can't stand it. I don't like it. But, and so also these people, this family and landline, they're kind of doing some bad things to each other or things that are really hurtful, and they're doing them on purpose.
Mm.
You know, they, you can't, like, if you're having an affair now, you can do half of your affair over the phone. You don't even, like, really have to have sex with that person. You know? In the
good
90s,
news,
like,
guys.
You gotta get in there.
I'll take your word on that one.
Yeah, sure, okay. Sure.
Now, a compliment to the movie for me is I did not realize it wasn't set today.
Oh, really?
I really didn't.
Huh.
It took me a while. I think because, in part maybe because I did grow up when phones weren't a thing that
right.
were attached, and computers and all those kinds of things. But to me, it just sort of felt like normal.
Uh-huh.
It felt more normal because I also find phones annoying for the most part.
Right.
They can really bug me in movies.
Yeah.
So for me, it was just like, no, this is just a family, and this is how they communicate with each other. And also, because you guys, you don't sort of... The wardrobe isn't anything where from a mile away you're like, oh, well, that's this, that's that.
It's not supposed to scream it. Because
right.
the 90s didn't scream the 90s when you were in them.
Absolutely
no, exactly.
not.
Yeah.
But that was why it took me a minute, is because
yeah.
everything just looked normal to me.
Right. And also the 90s are back a little bit.
Right.
Are they?
They are, yeah.
Oh, Daddy,
I didn't get the memo.
Daddy. Remember how you had that choker on the other day and everyone was like, that's really on fleek. That's what happened.
Oh,
that's
okay.
what had happened.
I'm so glad you explained that.
You're welcome. no, it's... Say, it was a funny thing is as soon as I did realize it, he said, he goes, that's interesting they said it in the 90s. And I went, they what?
Yeah.
Well, which frankly all came together as I was watching it and you were the California Raisins because
right.
then I went, all right, because I don't know who knows that anymore.
California
also,
Raisins are majorly
brilliant,
90s.
Brilliant yeah. costumes.
Yeah.
I was so happy and I text, there you go.
Yeah.
I text one of my best friends and was like, I have an idea for Halloween.
Well, because it's a great costume because so many women, you know, really go overboard in being like crazy, crazy sexy on Halloween. And I like the California Raisin because you can have a really pretty face, you know, and look like a pretty backup dancer from
uh-huh.
like the 50s. But then your whole body's just a trash bag. But then your legs stick out.
Yeah.
And then so you can have like cute little legs and like purple high heels.
I really
did you ever
like
see those
you
old commercials from even before my time from the 50s? You can find them online all over the place of dancing cigarette packs.
Yeah,
yeah
totally.
Right, yeah.
With long legs and high
yeah.
heels.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I really like that. I remember seeing those as a little girl. We had like a VHS tape of classic commercials.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, Brill Cream, whatever, like that
right.
kind of shit. But then it was like, oh, I'm sorry.
A little dabble do ya.
A little dabble do ya. But there was a dancing cigarette thing. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, those cigarettes are so pretty.
Right?
Right? Yeah.
I like red lips.
I love when legs stick out of stuff in general. I like love that.
Just
that
in
is
life.
So satisfying to me. I love when... When like women are dressed like strawberries and their like legs stick out. I think it's so cool.
For those of you at home taking notes, there
say.
Will be a quiz.
I love
afterwards.
It.
I love the idea of if you're trying to describe yourself to someone else and you just explain in detail, like, here are the things I like.
Yeah.
I like women dressed as strawberries with their legs sticking
I
out.
I do,
going,
man.
Okay.
That's like very dead on for me, to be honest.
That's okay.
Now, you have built several careers simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
One is acting and acting in mostly in sitcoms.
Yeah.
In very good sitcoms. And you've had some great parts that
oh,
are really...
God. Parks and Rec. God. God, you're funny.
Thank
God,
you.
Oh, my. That just... The thing is, you and your brother,
yeah,
Ben Schwartz, who is one of the funniest people...
He's really funny.
...that exists.
Yeah.
When the two of you come onto Parks and Rec, what happened to me is that I wouldn't be able to hear it because I just start to laugh.
It's a free for all. It's insane. Yeah.
I couldn't stop laughing. And that's how my mom knows you. That's how she initially found you. My first thing with you is Marcel the Shell, which we will talk about for anybody who doesn't know it. But then Parks and Rec happened.
Yeah.
And you're so funny, but the character's so great.
Heinous.
And then from there, for me, it's Kroll Show.
Yeah.
Which is, again, every time you're saying the name Liz right now, mm-hmm. I'm laughing.
Yes.
And I'm trying really hard not to.
My Liz says, like, Liz.
I know.
It's almost like a W. It's like the laziest way that you can speak.
I know.
Oz.
I know.
So ugly.
The niece.
I love to step on it.
The niece.
My niece Denise, yeah.
My niece Denise. Yeah. That is, I will actually look at people with that face. And if they don't understand, I explain it's a mixture of Amy Sedaris from Strangers with Candy.
Uh-huh.
And then Denise the niece.
You know, Denise is just me as a teenager.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's a character that two of the characters I played on the Kroll Show, one is Denise, and one is Ruth Diamond Phillips is her name.
So good.
Are actually two characters from a one-woman show that I did in New York and then brought into the Kroll Show, and they became what they were there. But, yeah, they're women I've been fascinated by for a while.
Now, is Liz of publicity inspired by anyone in particular? We say that acknowledging, full disclosure, that there is a very fine publicist
sitting
here in this room at the moment who would not be a role model for Liz. Quite the opposite. But did you encounter people who kind of fired those ideas?
Well, I will say about Liz and Liz, I did not invent those women. Mm-hmm. Those are an invention of Nick Kroll.
Okay.
But I plugged into them. Because, and also when we invented them, or when we started to do them, reality shows were even different than they are now.
Very much so.
Because the weirdest thing is now they're normalized. Mm. Like, I remember when reality shows started, I was really grossed out by, you know, by the lack of deportment and grace that was going on. And just the weird things that were being said. Like, one thing that's said on reality shows all the time are, people being like, I just think you really need help. I think you really need therapy. Like, you need to see someone. And it's like, okay, well, that's very ignorant. It's actually, to me, feels really dangerous. It's like every single person, I believe, should go and see a therapist. It's lovely. Do your mental health. It's cool. It's like the stigma on it is very ignorant and sort of implies that if your emotional state isn't perfect and in control, then there's something wrong with you. And that is a huge bummer. But so at the time we were watching reality shows and being like, these people are gross, you know, and they're weird. They're weird that they want to be on television and be seen when they haven't earned it. You know, they're like people
so
who
nice
want to be popular.
Say this.
I never watch reality TV. And I can't take it lightly. I can't take it lightly, especially when our president is a reality TV star and he's so, so horrible. I just can't handle it. And I don't like how it's normal. So anyway, I believe that those publicists were based off of maybe people that Nick had encountered. And then I was able to kind of plug into it because it was part of something that I was seeing that at the time was shocking. And now something that I can't look at because I don't like the comfortable seat it's been given in our zeitgeist. I think it's disgusting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate it. Hate it. Cannot stand it.
About two years ago, I said to my dad, reality TV is going to change because when it started, people really didn't think about cameras, and so you could catch more natural ridiculousness as opposed to now where everyone knows what the people make speeches.
They're like the new Terminators. They're like evolved.
But what started happening was everybody would say something along the lines of, I can't believe you did this to me on national television.
Right.
And as soon as that was happening on a very regular basis, I said to my dad, they're going to have to change something because now that they keep acknowledging the TV, people are going to keep being pulled out. And so when you're watching this for mindless entertainment, if someone keeps going, I just can't believe you embarrass me on national television every day. And every show was saying that, every single one.
Right.
And I just went, and sure enough, the next year, Real World had changed and they now had cell phones and you are now seeing the crew.
Right.
They were showing you how they would talk to the crew and how they would mic up and things like that. They would show you on Teen Mom. All of a sudden, you could see the whole crew. It was the whole thing.
It's really irresponsible. Mm. If you think that kind of output doesn't have a really poisonous effect on our society, like a collective degradation. I really feel strongly about it. It freaks me out. I don't like it. Sometimes I wonder, I'm like, is this how people felt about Elvis or something? And then I'm like, no, man. Elvis was like a cosmic artist. These are like major, what you might call like hungry ghosts. And I can't stand it.
I think that's a rather kind description, but go ahead.
I don't like it. No. I don't like it.
I do a whole spiel. I teach a class at USC here in Los Angeles. And we show new movies and have the filmmakers as guests. Mm. And whenever we have our first documentary of the particular semester, I have this whole long spiel that I do about the difference between a documentary and reality television.
Yeah, you have to.
Because there's nothing less real than reality television.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's important that these young people know it if they don't already.
Yeah.
And it's important that they build a wall of skepticism.
You know what's really interesting? So, I mean, not to turn this on myself, but our Marcel the Shell feature film that my ex-husband and I are making together is a documentary. And that was the format of the shorts in the first place, right? Mm. And we've had to come up against this thing where it's like, well, in a world that's actually used to now seeing two camera interviews, like to the camera, not double, mm-hmm. two camera, whatever. Mm-hmm. How do we make sure that people know that we're making a documentary film and not a reality show, or not even something like The Office, which is the most lovely example of breaking that fourth wall and sort of mockumentary, that, that's wonderful. And we started to just really talk about documentary and watch films and say, like, we'll just kind of use the template, because basically Marcel is a portrait of an individual who is other, but doesn't know anything but to either have neutral or curious feelings about that otherness or to celebrate it. And we looked at films like Billy the Kid. I don't know if you've seen that documentary. It's really, really wonderful. And also we're like, well, we want this to be like a Maisel's film, or in its most gentle way, like a Weissman film. You know, like that sweet gentleness that you feel when you watch Blind or High School, where you just are watching people kind of trying to do their thing, or even The Store. Like I love those films, and we've had to work really hard to call out the difference to ourselves, reality TV and the way that they wrangle a narrative and the way that they oversimplify characters, and really it's boring and repetitive, and it's almost like they beat you down with that repetition. Mm. And that a good documentary consistently reveals without answering every single question.
Right.
Because you're not owed that in life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Frederick Wiseman is kind of a miracle worker.
Uh-huh.
And he just got an Honorary Academy Award last year, and has been making films for more than 50 years now.
Yeah.
And made some really, really important films early on, the Titicut Follies and High School and other films that are tremendously influential. But the thing that he continues to do to this day is he never has narration.
Right, he never does. And we do.
He lets the story unfold before you as it's not as it's happening. He uses editing. But,
right.
But it speaks for itself.
Yes. Mm.
And and very few filmmakers have the guts to do that, and he does.
Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little about your film, though.
Well, Dean, my ex-husband and I, we made Marcel the Shell, the first short, I believe in 2010, and we made it really out of we need to do something creative. I was like, I knew I was about to be fired from Saturday Night Live, and I was really pretty sad, just embarrassed and heartbroken and a million different feelings. And one thing I really love about Dean is that he kind of has a real back kick against any sort of authority and any sort of a system that says you can only do art in one way, or we give you permission, and that he'll park in front of a hydrant. He just has a problem with authority that I was always interested in, and I don't have. I'm a pretty obedient person. I'm kind of like a pet. I'm like a good pet, and then if you leave me alone, I'm like a bad pet, and I knock off knock the trash over, stuff like that. But anyway, he was just waiting for them to tell you when you can be funny.
Yeah.
And so we made this thing together, and he designed Marcel character design. He directed it, edited it. We wrote it together, and I performed it, and we improvised all of it.
And people can find many examples.
On YouTube.
Yes,
on
there are YouTube. Three of them.
As you're talking about, I can't stop smiling because all of the lines are just playing in my head. And that's the thing, is that what you've created is something just lovely. And like you're talking about, lovely and sweet and wonderful. And whenever I think about it, I start to laugh and smile. And that is not something everyone can do.
Oh, I'm
so
glad.
So that's an art. It is. It is an art.
So what's the concept for the feature?
Well, I don't know how much I'm able to reveal, but it really is Marcel. Well, one of the things that happens is that we watch Marcel react to being put on the internet, and his feelings about. And when we meet him, he's alone in an apartment living with his grandmother, and we learn the story of how they ended up alone. They used to have a whole community, and we learn about that. And I really don't want to reveal too much.
That's okay.
Yeah. We're not going to try to.
But one of the things that we sort of deal with is the difference between having an audience and having a community.
Mm-hmm.
And how it feels to. How if you have an audience and you don't have a community and you used to have a community but now you have an audience, how that can create a really deep sense of loneliness.
Well, mm-hmm. Talking at versus talking to.
Yeah.
And it's, I find it, so I live at home.
Yes.
And my parents and I talk a lot.
Yeah.
Like a lot.
Uh-huh.
More than probably people should speak to each other.
I talk with my parents a lot, too.
But that I realize sometimes that when I'm traveling or I'm on my own, that I will not speak to anybody for a day.
Yeah.
Just if I'm by myself and this thing's going on, you kind of won't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
And the thing that I miss most when I travel, and I realized it, was hugging. I really miss a solid hug.
Yeah.
And as cheesy as it sounds, that will be when, if I'm somewhere and I'm enjoying just exploring, I'll try to plan a day trip to where I know somebody.
Yeah.
Just so I can get a real hug.
Yeah.
And then I'm good again.
That's really
like
nice.
Like, it juices me up and I'm okay.
Yeah.
And then a little while later, I kind of go, yeah, I need another hug.
Yeah.
Need a hug, I think.
That makes sense.
But just for anybody who doesn't know your story, just quickly, so with SNL, because you're talking about getting fired, and it's not because you did something horrible or awful.
No.
The way SNL works is if you curse because it's live.
Oh, I wasn't fired for that.
I thought that was what it was.
No. And you know what? Also, to be honest, a woman in The Observer asked me about cursing on SNL.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just... gotta say, I know it must be interesting, but first of all, I've answered this question hundreds of times before. Secondly, since I did one thing by mistake in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. on the first night of a new job, that, mm-hmm. by the way, was my childhood dream. So, you know, a lot of nerves.
Yeah.
Since I made that one very electric mistake, I have done a lot of powerful things on purpose.
Yeah.
I'm a New York best-selling author, you know, New York Times best-selling author, and I've, like, made these movies, and I've done all this shit, and I've, like... I'm a full person.
Yeah.
And I just don't know if I would have to keep speaking about this.
Sure.
If I were a man, like, would I be able to speak about my accomplishments, or why do I have to keep talking about this one thing that I, like, didn't even do?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I did it, but I didn't do it. It was a mistake. Why can't I talk about the things I do on purpose?
Well, hang on a second. Let's talk about your New York Times best-selling book, then.
Yeah.
I want to turn this into a positive conversation.
Sure. But I'm not trying to get in your face
no,
at
not
all.
No, not at all. Not at
I
all.
I just think, I almost feel like if there's a moment to set it straight,
sure.
for why it doesn't work,
yeah.
you kind of have to say it.
Yeah.
Because you have to be specific about why something doesn't work. Otherwise, it just seems like you're being touchy.
Hmm.
Does that make any sense?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
No, for me, the way that I think about it is because you're saying it to listeners who may or may not know you.
Yeah.
I want them to understand how talented you are and how much you've done.
Yeah.
So when you say, I was fired from SNL.
I was fired, but I just wasn't good at it. That's why I was fired. Because I wasn't good.
All right, so let's talk about things you are good at.
Yeah.
You do wonderful cartoon voices.
Oh, thank you.
You were part of two of the most successful animated films of the last couple of years.
I know. It's so
Zootopia.
Weird. Yeah.
And The Secret Life of Pets.
Yeah.
And so you've got a whole nother track on your career.
Yeah.
Because you have this ability to do these wonderful voices,
yeah,
which we first heard with Marcel Lachelle. Do you enjoy doing animated cartoon characters?
I love it. And you know what? I always knew that I would. I've always loved cartoons. But I also, you know, it's really nice if your creative work or your career or whatever can have a real personal holiness to it, the way in which, like, I mean, I'm an agnostic Jew, you know, like, I'm not religious anymore in that way, but, you know, when you go to the synagogue in the ark or whatever, in the synagogue, there's, like, things that are the items of holiness. There's, like, the breastplate for the Torah, and it's, like, this jeweled thing. I always loved it as a kid because it's, like, jewelry.
Same.
It's, like, a big necklace for the Torah.
I like staring at the sparkly objects.
Yeah, totally. Yes. Yes. But, you know, so there, to me, are some sort of jewels of my faith and my, like, the holiness of being an actress. It's, like, something I've worshipped, you know, in a really, like, not a fetishy way. Like, I'm like, this is a thing. This is a beautiful thing. And anyway, it always felt like the special performers were the ones who were allowed to do the voices for Disney cartoons. And it was, like, Robin Williams as the genie, you know? Like, that. It started to turn. It was like,
yes,
the Little Mermaid, who's in this? I don't know.
No, you
know,
Robin Williams doing that voice was a major,
right,
game changer.
Yeah. Yes, and I remember it, and I remember being like, whoa, they think he's so funny that they don't even need to see him. They just want him to get in the booth and, like, literally, there was this thing in Massachusetts in Boston at the Museum of Science. It was a lightning show where they had these two big balls and they would, like, a guy would get in a cage and turn on the lightning and the balls would get zapped, you know, like,
wow,
one of those things. And that's what it reminded me of. I'm like, he's just doing his lightning in the thing. And I want to do my lightning in the thing, and I love cartoons, and if I can do it, it means that people think that I have a light in me, and they can just, they, like, a light that you can hear, you know? It's like, you can't just show up to a cartoon and do a thing.
No.
It's not, no. If you think you're showing up there in your, I mean, some people show up in their sweatpants, but, like, I don't. And I love it, and I feel really passionate about it, and it's a certain type of acting. It is not just you and your voice. I mean, it can be, but,
well, like, first off, you don't generally get to work opposite another actor,
right,
when you do
those
voices.
You don't get
voices
to feed off the energy,
yeah,
of other people.
And you have to, and of course the directors are I'm sure feeding you lines and,
right,
and coaching you and having you do different readings and all of that. But still, you've got to come up to a level of energy and believability.
Yeah.
In a vacuum, sort of.
Yeah.
And I've always found that amazing.
Yeah.
It's really, like, you know what I love? In The Secret Life of Pets, there's, like, a part where I play a dog, and she, like, falls out a window.
Mm-hmm.
And straight up, like, you're just like, you know, it's like singing. It's like, yeah, being a bizarre instrument and just imagining it. You don't know what it will look like. You know your job is to give as many options as possible. It just feels wonderful. And then there's, like, the added thing, which is, you know, I love animation in general, and Miyazaki is one of my favorite filmmakers, mm-hmm, animation or live action. Like, Miyazaki makes me feel okay. Really, like, if I am upset, if I watch Totoro, you know, I'm like, okay. Like, Kiki's Delivery Service, mm-hmm, is a major one for me, and Spirited Away is, like, one of the things that I remember, like, having in common with some of my very best friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to be in that world. That's it. I just want to, like, be a person in that world.
Well, you're in it.
Yeah.
You're in it big time.
I love it. Oh.
You're in it big time.
And then that, our Marcel thing is, like, you know, it's like my offering to the gods. That's what it feels like.
If anybody hasn't seen it before, God, I can't imagine how many views it has to have at this point. It's got to be insane.
I think it's a little over 26 million.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Because, yeah, it's just This is the thing, and I'm enjoying sitting here having this moment of thinking of Gidget, of thinking of Bellwether, of thinking of the different characters you've played, because they all make me laugh and smile. And Marcel, for anybody who hasn't seen it, you can go onto YouTube, and it's a shell. It is literally Marcel the shell with shoes on.
Yeah, he's a one-eyed shell with shoes.
Mm-hmm. And he's going to tell you about his life.
Yeah.
And, you know, how he does things.
Yeah.
You know, life as a shell is not always easy.
Sure.
And, you know, he wants a pet. He likes to wear hats.
Yeah.
And he
you
has...
You can watch him talk on the phone.
And he has a phenomenal voice.
He does.
Now, let me ask you, with the big feature films...
Yeah.
Did they call you in and ask you to find or create a voice? Did they give you specific ideas of what kind of voice they wanted? Or were they interested in working with you because they knew you would bring something interesting to the table?
I've got to say, I am not sure. Like, although it's something I want, it's like kind of mystical to me. I mean, it literally was like, I got an email that was like, Disney would like you to be in a movie called Zootopia. They didn't tell me anything about my character. I heard that I was going to be a sheep. I was like, that's great. I love sheep so much. I'll do it. I had no idea what it would be. But I think they do know that I'm coming in with a little, you know, a little bag of voices. You know, like I'm coming to come in with tricks. But actually, in those movies, like the voice that I do for Bellwether is sort of a smoother version of my own or more like my own. And the voice that I do for Gidget is not that far off from my own either. In some of the other movies, like in The Lorax, I do a different voice for Ted's mom. And I'm in Despicable Me 3, and like I'm kind of doing a Fran Drescher sort of yelling Fran Drescher sort of thing. You know,
that's always a good thing.
I don't know. I hope that they want me for my energy, but you know.
I can't imagine they don't.
I don't know the answer.
No, but you play these characters that are adorable and have big personalities.
Yeah.
So I think that they, I mean, and Rich Moore is a smart guy.
Yeah, man.
One of the directors of Zootopia is a very smart guy. He knows what he's doing.
Yeah, they're so nice at Disney.
They're the nicest
human. They wait outside for you. Like, I would park in the parking lot, and, like, the whole team is waiting there. I used to think... I was like, is somebody making them do this, or are they, like, this nice? And it just turns out, like, they're that nice.
They're that nice.
They're so nice. And, gotta say, really good snacks.
See?
At Disney.
These are the important things.
Insane.
There you go.
Snacks at Disney. Yeah.
Feed them well, folks.
Yeah.
And they will respond.
Like, fancy salamis and stuff. It's not just like, here's some grapes. You know, it's just like, here's a salami platter.
I don't know if they teach that in animation school.
I don't know.
Well, they should.
There you go.
You'd be firm on that.
Now, to bring an idea full circle, I mentioned early on you were wearing a Jean-Luc Godard titled T-shirt.
Yes.
And before we started rolling, you said that you find that there are either Godard people or Truffaut people.
Yeah.
And that you are, in fact, a Truffaut person.
I am. Yeah.
And what's your favorite?
My favorite is Small Change.
Mm-hmm. A beautiful film.
Yeah.
A very tough, emotional film.
Yeah. And also, like, really hopeful and really faithful, really full of faith. Like, for example, when the little baby falls out the window, the way that entire thing is, that he hangs there for a second, and everyone's like, and you feel everyone's panic, and you just feel everyone's heart, and that, like, it ends up kind of being okay, that it can work out without it being sappy. Mm-hmm. There's something about the connection in that moment. Or, you know, like, when the little girl wants to bring her purse to the restaurant, and she washes it in the fishbowl, and her parents are just like, you're not bringing that. The mom's like, you're not bringing that thing. And they leave her there. And I just, it's not cruel, though. It's just, it's always cut and dry. Mm. It's just kind of like, yeah, you know, this is the haircut that you got. Sorry, you got a weird haircut, you know? And then there's just a little boy, the sort of homeless little boy. These are such extremes, but they're all in the same world. I've never really seen anyone put something together like that, but I will say that the one time that I felt that I'm being given something to have in the same way was when I saw Beginners.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I felt that there was a connection there that reminded me of Truffaut.
You're talking about Mike Mills' film?
I am.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I felt that way.
Ewan McGregor and Christopher Plummer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Melanie Laurent, who I think is just so gorgeous in every way. Not just how she looks. I think she's just wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved her film, Breathe. Have you seen that movie?
No, I haven't seen it. I'm embarrassed to say.
It's really good. It's pretty intense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I liked it. Yeah.
So are you a Francophile in general? Do you like French movies overall?
I don't know. I just like a lot of things. I don't think I'm a Francophile, but I my grandmother, Rochelle, who was born in Havana, grew up in Paris, so I do feel that I have some sort of a tie to that kind of whole thing. But I love Truffaut, and I love Jacques Tati.
Mm-hmm.
And my father showed me Mr. Hulot's Holiday when I was a little girl, and I remember being pissed about it. I didn't understand it, and I thought I didn't get it.
Yeah.
And then years later, when I met my now ex-husband, friend, he's still very close to me, he was like, oh, have you ever seen Mon Oncle? And I was like, isn't that the guy who does Mr. Hulot's Holiday? Isn't it boring? And he was like, it's so odd. You don't seem like someone who would think that. And I was like, ooh, you're right. I think I thought that when I was six. I don't think I've seen this. And then we watched Mon Oncle, and we watched Playtime, and we watched Mr. Hulot's Holiday again. And what is the one where they're in the car for so long?
Oh, yeah. Traffic.
Traffic. Yeah. And, like, I was like, oh, these are actually, this is, like, my thing.
Yeah.
This is my major thing. So I love that. Then you know what else I love? Like, I love Aki Kaurismäki a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, we just saw his newest film at the Carlo Vivari
International Film Festival.
Yeah. Yes, called The Other Side of Hope.
Oh, how was it? Did you like it?
It's very good.
I love his movies. What is the one? It's like there's a little boy refugee.
Le Havre.
Le Havre is so, that movie. That also kind of reminds me of Truffaut.
Hmm.
Yeah.
You know, there's that innocent connection.
Yeah.
I really love it. And also, I like Roy Anderson. Is that his name?
It's someone's name.
I'm going to have to look into
it. It's a person's name.
I'm going to have to ask my ex-husband. Yeah.
So we also asked you
about,
well, there's two things. You and I spoke for a minute about this incredible thing you do on Instagram that you wanted to talk about a little bit.
Oh.
I am new to the Instagram.
Yeah.
I don't understand much about it, except that there's all kinds of stuff there.
There's
and
lots.
If I sit for too long, I get swallowed.
You gotta get off. Yeah, I put out. I don't really take in very much.
Sure.
And I don't like those Instagram stories. I think they're too much. I do. I think it's too much.
Sure.
And I think
I haven't done one. I don't know.
Yeah, with any industrial revolution, you actually kind of have to like think about your humanity when you start to use the tools. Otherwise, you kind of erase humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think one thing I got really interested in college was like this sense that at the same time that, you know, like when Central Park was invented or created, it was like the first time that people of many classes were in the same space together at a certain time. And that beautiful thing that created that connection. And also, like, if you read something like John Dos Passos' Manhattan Transfer, this idea that, like, people could suddenly connect to each other so much faster than they used to, and how that's wonderful, but also really messes with the natural pace of stuff, like a pace that's very important. And I feel that same way about like Instagram and the internet and cell phones. And we talked about that. But anyway, this thing I did on Instagram.
It's waving. It's a bit like wax on, wax off. It's a little bit like that.
Well, I was just talking to my therapist about how I'm obsessed with circles.
Okay.
And they make me feel really good. And my first memory from my life is a dream that I had as a baby. That I can remember, like, it's the first thing I can remember is, like, this dream where I was floating in my house and there were all these circles around me, like, circles, like, from a twister board, kind of, but they weren't paper. They were in the air. And I love circles. And when I'm happy, I feel like my circles are around me. And I'm really into David Lynch, and I'm really into Twin Peaks, and I always have been, and I know everyone else is, and it's not, like, making me unique, but I just love it. And what I love about it is this feeling that I have that's like, well, you could write a dissertation on this, or you could admit that there's an invisible column of light and energy that goes from your heart into this piece of art, and you can connect to it like a weird alien and just be like, wah, and let it have you like a beam, like when people get drawn into a spaceship and just be there suspended. And that's how I take that art in, and I love it. you know? And that's what I feel about my own circles, is that I'm like, my circles are really happening this morning. So I'm going to get on Instagram and show everyone my circles. And some people are going to be like, whatever's going on there, I get it. And some people are going to be like, you're weird. You know? And then I'm like, okay. Because well,
you know whatever. You may have read, because it's been reprinted many times, the late anthropologist Stephen Jay Gould wrote a very famous essay about why Mickey Mouse is so enduringly appealing.
Oh.
And the answer is...
his ears?
Circles.
Circles.
Really?
He's
circles.
Round. This yeah. is why babies respond to Mickey Mouse, who've never mm-hmm. seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon.
What is it?
And even wow. young children who've never seen a Mickey Mouse cartoon just respond to the look of the character.
Kidding.
No. It's why yeah. I think people like us, we're very round.
Oh.
We just instantly, people are into it.
I mean, you should have seen my therapist's face this week when I was trying to tell her about my circles.
Oh, boy.
I was like, is this when she calls the hospital?
Right.
Well, have her read Stephen Jay Gould.
Okay.
You call her on the phone.
So maybe I'm connecting to something that's actually like a thing that happens.
I think it sounds like it.
It sounds like I'm a baby.
It sounds
is
like
what it sounds like. It sounds like.
Well, believe it or not, we have come full circle.
Oh.
And eaten up, and I think rather enjoyably, an hour of time.
What a fun time. I could have talked to you guys forever. I like that you're father and daughter doing
we
that.
We are.
Well, and it's true. We are.
It's really nice.
I like that he says that like confirmation for me. And I am. My mom always says we look too much alike for it to be the MILF ban. So that's apparently.
So, Jenny, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here and for giving your wonderful. You emanate a real spirit.
Oh,
you emanate
thank you.
Circles.
Circles, yeah. man.
Among other things. Among many other things.
And hamburgers.
And let's remind people that they should, well, if you haven't seen Obvious Child, you should definitely catch
yes.
up with that.
It's on Netflix.
And then
yes.
you should look out for your new film, Landline.
Mm. Yeah.
Which opens July 21st.
Yes.
And
then everywhere else, like August 4th, it will okay. expand. And from what I understand, like, you know, you really got to go see it to sort of foster this expansion. So I really hope that that people go see it, because I'm very proud of it, and I love it.
It's a good movie to talk about.
Yeah.
Those are always there, too.
Yeah, you'll talk about it
it's an interesting thing to see. Now I'm married, and so my husband's the fourth part of what was the Molten Triangle. Now suddenly we're a square. It's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
But... that has always been a ritual. My parents coming home from movies at night especially when I was in school and younger and couldn't go to all of them.
Yeah.
They come home, we sit down, and they talk to me about the movie. Now that I am a free woman and can do as I please and tend to go with them to movies.
Sure.
It's really nice.
That's what you choose.
But that, yeah.
As a free woman. No, I do too, by the way.
As a free
I love
woman,
my parents.
I'm like, listen.
Any time off I have, I either call my parents on the phone or go and see them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I get it.
People ask if we live near each other. My mom says, yeah, downstairs. That's one of my favorite things, though, is to talk about movies.
Yeah.
So after we watched yours, that was something I really enjoyed, was kind of going, well, what did you feel? And
yeah.
what did you
yeah.
find? And yeah. What did you think about this? And what did you notice about that? And I always appreciate those movies.
Oh, good. I'm
that
glad.
That make you talk.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's do our social media plug-in.
Yes.
Oh.
Where are your things and stuff?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, yeah, I'm Jenny Slate on Twitter, but really, you should just go see my movie. That's all I care about. If you want to go see my Twitter, you can hear me talk about how I don't like the bodies exhibit and I think it's gross.
But on Instagram, you like to show off your pretty outfits.
Oh, I love. I love
fashion.
Clothes. I do. I love clothes. But I only ever show them off, really, when I have a specific thing. I buy things on Etsy from strangers I don't know.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then I put those things up because those people, you know, my mom's an artist and we spent a lot of weekends at crafts fairs
mm-hmm.
and there was no Etsy then.
Right.
So it makes me feel good to like put those people's stuff out
Absolutely.
There. Absolutely. But also I take pictures of myself in clothing made by women for women, small companies. Usually they're made in Brooklyn or LA. And that's what you can see on my Instagram.
Lovely.
And circles.
And my dog.
See, that's all I need.
Yeah.
Give me clothes and dogs.
Yeah.
And I'm a very happy human being. And where do they find us?
Where do they find us? They find us.
I'm at Jesse Malton. You're at Leonard Malton on the Twitter and on the Instagram, and you're on Facebook. And you can go to www.leonardmalton.com for movie reviews. And he'll talk to you about the different festivals we're going to and why we haven't slept in days and we don't know what country we're in. And everything.
And film books and mm-hmm. all sorts of stuff. And DVDs and
Many
stuff like that.
Many book roundups.
There. Anyway, we hope you'll catch up with us in one form or another, and that you'll come back and listen next week for another episode.
Just for the heck of it, let's just mention to people, because whatever time it is they're listening to this, they can look for No Maps on My Taps.
Oh, well, it's a wonderful, wonderful documentary about that was made in 1978 and has just been restored and re-released by Milestone Film. As we speak, it's playing in one theater in New York. I don't know how much of a theatrical run it will have.
What one? What theater?
You can purchase it.
At the Quad.
Yeah.
Okay.
Quad Cinema.
You can purchase it, and all the information is at leonardmalton.com. You can look up No Maps on My Taps.
A beautiful film about three veteran tap dancers.
Cool.
Yeah.
And how they expressed their lives through their tap dancing. Mm-hmm. Their lives are a reflection. I mean, their dancing is a reflection of their lives.
Yeah. Mm.
And it's very moving and quite beautiful. Thank you for reminding me.
You are welcome.
Okay, and we'll see you guys next time. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Now leaving Nerdist.com.